and gentlemen. Our first case of the morning is Harley Davidson against Power Sports. Mr. Stone.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Peter Stone, and I represent the appellant in this case, Harley Davidson Motor Company. This case is before the court on review of a summary judgment decision granted by Judge Stadmiller in the Eastern District of Wisconsin. In the district court, PowerSport moved for summary judgment on two grounds. The first ground being that Harley Davidson's claim for rescission, which was based upon alleged fraudulent misrepresentations made to it in the context of approving the sale of a dealership in Florida, are barred by the economic loss doctrine. The second ground on which PowerSport moves for summary judgment was that even if the economic loss doctrine doesn't bar Harley Davidson's claim for rescission, there is no evidence to support the claim. There is no genuine dispute, and they ought to be granted summary judgment on the merits.
Mr. Stone, let me just ask you this. If PowerSport pressed ahead with the plans that they expressed in the draft business plan, wouldn't it clearly breach the contract?
Yes, we think there would have been contract breaches. There's two separate contracts to keep in mind here. Harley Davidson was asked to approve the transfer of this dealership to Power Sports. The approval it gave was the first agreement. Once it gave that approval, then Power Sports would succeed to the dealer contract. Some of the things Power Sports proposed to do would be breach of the dealer contract. Others might not be. They went to really the heart of the dealership philosophy, the marketing plans for the business.
But then what would stand in Harley Davidson's way of, in other words, Harley Davidson waited to see if that happened and then sue for breach of contract? What's wrong with that scenario?
Well, this isn't a breach of contract case.
No, what I'm saying to you is if you wait, that happens, then you sue.
And if Power Sports never did what it said it was going to do, and in fact it hasn't done much of it, it's deferred its plans potentially because of this lawsuit.
Right.
Harley Davidson would essentially be forced to continue to do business with someone that had lied to it, that had cheated, had made material misrepresentations to it. What Harley Davidson's lost in this case was the opportunity to make an informed decision about whether to approve or disapprove the proposed sale based upon all of the facts that should have been available to it at the time.
Well, would there be any way that Power Sports could press ahead with the plans that were stated in those business, you know, those drafts and still hold on to the dealership?
No.
Right. So what would motivate Power Sports to breach the dealer contract unless it really wants to get out of the Harley Davidson business?
Well, it's Harley Davidson's view that much of that activity would constitute a breach of the dealer contract. Power Sports, we suspect, would have a different point of view, and we would end up in litigation over whether or not there was good cause for termination of the dealer contract. But if Power Sports is allowed to simply decide if and when it's going to do the things it didn't disclose to Harley Davidson, we'd be in the same situation as an employee who lied on his employment application. And the employer finds out about it later, but so long as the employee does his job, there's nothing you can do about it. We'd be condoning fraud and misrepresentation and letting someone get away with that. And the law has never allowed that. The law has always provided for rescission of a contract based upon fraud or material misrepresentation. We think the trial court here really fundamentally misunderstood and misapplied Wisconsin's economic loss doctrine to prevent Harley Davidson from going forward with its rescission claim. The economic loss doctrine, as you know, has been adopted in many states now. In Wisconsin, it dates back to the Sunny Slope case in 1989. It developed originally in the products liability context, but the economic loss doctrine prevents some tort claims for economic loss or commercial injury. What it prevents are claims to recover damages for what are defined to be economic losses, originally in the products context, meaning damage to property itself, such as for cost of repair or replacement, and consequential damages, such as lost income, loss of goodwill, perhaps reliance damages. The economic loss doctrine has never barred recovery of all damages between contracting parties. For example, if there's a personal injury involved or there's damage to other property, the economic loss doctrine has always permitted recovery of those types of damages.
Now, of course, it seems as if the Supreme Court of Wisconsin is going to soon resolve whether or not there's a fraud exception.
Yes, and that's really a different issue than we have here today to a large extent. We're not asking this court to overrule its decision in Home Value v. Pep Boys. There is a disagreement between this court and at least several of the courts of appeal in Wisconsin as to whether or not there should be an exception to the economic loss doctrine for fraud. But in Pep Boys, the type of damages that Home Value was attempting to recover there were damages which were traditionally precluded by the economic loss doctrine. In that case, Home Value alleged that misrepresentations had been made to it in connection with the sale of a business and the extension of the closing deadline. And Home Value, based on that, went ahead and spent a considerable amount of money shutting down the store that it was operating. In other words, it relied on the representations were made to it. Those aren't damages for injury to other property or damages for injury to person, so they typically would have fallen within the scope of the economic loss doctrine unless there's an exception for fraud.
But let's go back. Let's assume that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin affirms DigiCorp. How, then, would we say that Harley-Davidson has been damaged by the revelation that Power Sports has considered going public and, more than that, transforming itself into an e-commerce business?
I'm not sure at this point that Harley-Davidson has been damaged, and we're not seeking damages in the case as it's currently formulated. DigiCorp, of course, followed the decision in Douglas Hanson, which also found that there was this fraud exception. We think if the Wisconsin Supreme Court upholds DigiCorp and essentially contradicts Home Value, there'll be no doubt whatsoever that in a case of fraud, the economic loss doctrine doesn't apply. But regardless of what the Wisconsin Supreme Court does with DigiCorp, even if they decide to follow Home Value, we still think the economic loss doctrine simply doesn't apply here. It only applies to claims where parties are seeking recovery, where parties are seeking damages, and it only limits certain types of damage recovery. It's never been held in any Wisconsin case or any decision of this court applying Wisconsin law to bar a claim for rescission. There's nothing really about a claim for rescission which gets at the heart of what the economic loss doctrine is all about.
Now, your opponent claims that in the district court, you made quite a point out of the fact this was a tort, not a contract case.
Well,
what's your answer to that?
I think it's a much ado about nothing, actually, Your Honor. There's no doubt that the basis of the claims we're asserting, the conduct at issue, is tortious conduct. The remedy we're seeking is really a remedy that traditionally has been characterized as sounding in contract. Rescission remedy is set forth in the Restatement of Contract Second, which Wisconsin has adopted. So whether you label it as a tort claim, which it is in the sense that the conduct is tortious, or as a contract claim because what we're doing is seeking rescission of a contract, really is irrelevant. You have to look at what the economic loss doctrine was designed to prevent.
So your view is let's call this a rescission claim, period, and that's the end of it.
That's fine. I don't think it really matters what you call it in terms of that label.
Am I correct that the this contract had a choice of law clause in it?
No, but the parties have agreed that Wisconsin law applies.
One of the pleadings in the lower court indicated, one of the parties stated in a footnote in one of the pleadings in the lower court that the contract had a choice of law.
The dealer contract itself has a choice of law provision in which applies Wisconsin law.
Mm-hmm.
The simple approval agreement that Harley-Davidson was induced to give was simply represented in a letter that was sent to Power Sports. That approval agreement itself didn't have a choice of law.
And you say the parties are in agreement that Wisconsin law
yes.
applies, even though this franchise was in Florida.
Yes.
I take it that, to your view, it would make utterly no sense for this court to defer any decision until DigiCorp is decided.
Well, we had suggested to the court that you might want to do that, because if DigiCorp is decided in the same way that Douglas Hanson was decided, if it's affirmed, then there will clearly be a fraud exception, and that would completely resolve the issue here. Even if it goes the other way, however, we think we still win.
Has the Wisconsin Supreme Court set that case for argument yet?
I'm not sure. Briefing was completed.
It has.
Yeah.
January 23rd.
Briefing's been completed January 23rd. So we wouldn't have to wait long, presumably, but we really don't think you have to wait.
Of course, if they had this case, then they would have the whole picture, wouldn't they? They'd
be able that was sort of our theory.
The distinction that you're urging, if they care to, or they could reject the theory that you're urging if they care to.
This would be a substantial extension of beyond where even this court has gone, and it would be opportune time for the Wisconsin Supreme Court to consider that issue. That's why we mentioned the DigiCorp case.
If we were to rule in your case independent of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, would there be a danger that we would be in conflict, at least on a theoretical basis, with the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
No, because the only thing the Wisconsin Supreme Court is deciding is whether there's a fraud exception to the economic loss doctrine in a damages case.
Mm-hmm.
The question of rescission is not in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court now. Never has been, and no Wisconsin court, as I mentioned, has ever decided the doctrine applies in a rescission case.
Of course, having meddled with their case law by our earlier decision, which apparently they're going to straighten out in the case they have before them now, I suppose it might not be a bad idea to let them have a crack at this particular issue in the first hand rather than repeat our forwardness a second time.
Well, that's why we suggested that it might be appropriate to at least give consideration to doing that, given the timing of the two cases. I think it's important to remember here that Harley-Davidson is not seeking to rewrite its agreement with Power Sports so that it can recoup its damages, a benefit that wasn't part of its bargain. Rather, Harley-Davidson simply seeks to avoid the bargain it was induced to enter by Power Sports misrepresentations. Permitting a party to rescind an agreement for misrepresentation does nothing to interfere with the fundamental distinction between tort law and contract law that really is the basis for the economic loss doctrine to begin with. Power Sports, perhaps recognizing the problems with its argument on the economic loss doctrine, has now on appeal urged this court to go ahead and grant its summary judgment on the underlying question of whether there's evidence to support the misrepresentation claim, even if you overruled Judge Stadmiller on the economic loss doctrine. Now, Judge Stadmiller, despite the fact that there were proposed findings of fact and responses and documents and voluminous filings at the trial court level, made no findings whatsoever on the question of whether or not there was a genuine dispute as to a material fact regarding misrepresentation.
Yeah, if the Supreme Court of Wisconsin affirms DigiCorp, are there facts, in your view, in dispute that would require us to remand the district court for consideration as to whether Harley-Davidson has an actionable misrepresentation claim?
Yes, that's what we've asked the court to do, in fact. The summary judgment motion was filed. It's been fully briefed. All the documents on there, it would be a simple matter for the district court to simply take up and analyze that issue, which it didn't do before. I know the court has the authority, certainly, to decide that issue, but in similar cases, you've noted that it's important to have a searching analysis of the record by the trial court level on a motion for summary judgment and have sent it back. Harley-Davidson, of course, is entitled to have the reasonable inferences from the record drawn in its favor, particularly in cases where intense fraud is important. Courts are often.
But your answer is that it would require us. That's what I.
Yes, my answer is that you should send it back to the trial court.
Okay.
Why is that necessary? Is there any dispute about the time at which Harley-Davidson received the offering circular? Power Sports says Harley-Davidson received it 6 hours before it signed mm-hmm. the approval of the transfer.
The sequence of events is interesting. On Monday, January 3rd in the afternoon, Harley-Davidson made its decision to approve the sale of this dealership to Power Sports. It wrote its letter on the 4th, Tuesday the 4th of January, and on the 5th of January, Harley-Davidson signed that letter. Mm-hmm. It was sent out on that day. The copy of the memorandum was delivered to the mailroom at Harley-Davidson on the same day the letter was sent out, but not actually physically delivered to anybody at Harley-Davidson until the next day. The company had been shut down for 2 weeks. There was simply a backlog in the mailroom. Curiously, though, Power Sports had contacted Harley-Davidson directly the day before the letter went out to find out when the letter was coming. They were told the letter was coming the next day, and it's our theory of the case, and we think there's substantial evidence to support it, that Power Sports really contrived to submit this memorandum at the very last moment when there was no opportunity whatsoever to respond to it. It's important to remember, once Harley-Davidson sent out its letter of approval under Florida law, it wasn't allowed to retract it. There was no longer an issue that could be decided by the Florida Department of Highway Safety. And the only thing that Harley-Davidson could do at that point was come to the district court as it did and seek rescission. See, my time is up. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Raven.
May it please the court, my name is Steve Raber from the law firm of Williams & Connolly, and I represent Power Sports Appellees. The issue on the economic loss doctrine, as framed by Harley-Davidson, really boils down to this. Does it make any difference that they are seeking rescission as a remedy as opposed to damages? And what's interesting about this case is how Harley's description of its claim has changed depending on which stage of litigation we're in. In the trial court, it described it as a common law tort claim. It did not tortious conduct, a common law tort claim, and
does
it did that.
Does description matter at all?
It does, because it matters because
the Florida agency, I gather, has already held that however it's described, it is not something within its purview.
If it's,
the
well,
claim for rescission had to be in Wisconsin rather than Florida, because your effort to have it adjudicated in Florida got thrown out.
That was a voluntary dismissal by both parties, Your Honor, in Florida. There was no ruling on the merits on that. That was withdrawn. But
after
it does
a preliminary adverse ruling, I gather.
Well, no, after a conference call, a scheduling type thing. There was nothing ruled on the merits. The point here is it does matter what the claim is, because the case law says we have to preserve the fundamental distinction between tort law and contract law.
Yeah.
And Harley-Davidson today is calling its claim a claim for rescission. Rescission is a remedy which is available either for torts in some circumstances or for contracts in some circumstances.
Yeah.
And Harley-Davidson
claim, if I were to articulate it, this is a claim for rescission because of fraud in the inducement. Right. The word fraud often summons up tort. The word rescission often summons up contract. But let's suppose we just call it a claim for rescission because of fraud in the inducement.
Mm-hmm.
Now, anything turn on that terminology?
Well, what's interesting, Your Honor, is that they filed a breach of contract claim for anticipatory repudiation and sought rescission on the same set of facts under a contract theory. And what the economic loss doctrine says is we don't want to allow parties to end run contract law and some of the protections that contract law provides,
let me give you another claim for rescission because of fraud in the inducement. A customer comes to a bank, a potential borrower comes to a bank and says, I'm a millionaire, I've got a chateau in France, I've got a staff of servants, I've got $25 million, please make me a $10 million revolving line of credit that I can draw on at will. Right, the bank agrees, signs this revolving line of credit. It's later revealed that he's a ditch digger and makes $19,000 a year.
Joe millionaire.
And the bank seeks to rescind this $10 million line of credit on the ground of fraud in the inducement. Do you think there's any chance that the Supreme Court of Wisconsin would say, no, sorry, the bank has to make the $10 million loan as soon as the papers are tendered, because the economic loss doctrine prevents it from rescinding the contract because of fraud in the inducement?
What this court has said that would
answer my question. My question has to do with a hypothetical and what
okay.
the Supreme Court
the,
of Wisconsin.
The answer would be if this is two commercial parties negotiating at arm's length with the benefit of counsel, if that representation and warranty was important to the bank, put it in the agreement. And if you have an agreement that has an integration clause in there, and you don't put it in the agreement, you're out of luck under the economic loss rule. That's the jurisprudence.
Even though that activity, as I've described it, would land you 10 years in the federal penitentiary.
That's possible.
You think the bank has to then throw the $10 million down the rat hole and never get it back?
Well, they might have a contract theory. They might have, I don't know what they would.
I don't know what it means to say they might have a contract theory. What the bank wants to do is not give the borrower the $10 million, which will then vanish. right? And it says our legal entitlement not to give them the $10 million is that we were lied to, there was fraud in the inducement, and that's why we agreed to make this loan. And, of course, all a revolving loan document will ever say is, we promised on your demand to give you $10 million. There's no more than that in one of these contracts.
The answer to that question, Your Honor, would be that to get their remedy for rescission, they would have to look to commercial law, whether it's the Uniform Commercial Code, whether it's commercial law, but not tort law.
Commercial law or anything else. I'm just trying to figure out what is it in the decisions of the Supreme Court of Wisconsin that makes you think that the bank would lose the case that I've described.
Because Dannon and Jansen says that it's important to maintain the fundamental distinction between tort and contract law, that tort law protects society as a whole from physical harm to person or property, and that if it's a commercial injury in a commercial dispute, tort law is an apt tool for resolving those disputes. And Harley-Davidson...
I'm asking you to get away from this classification exercise. The argument you are making amounts to saying that Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, has abolished the doctrine that a contract can be rescinded because of fraud in the inducement. Now, if there's some clue about that in Wisconsin cases, that would be good to see. That's the kind of claim that's being made here. It's the burden of your answer to my hypothetical. But I just can't believe that the state of Wisconsin has essentially by accident abolished the doctrine of fraud in the inducement.
Well, Cooper Power says that commercial disputes are resolved according to principles of commercial law rather than tort principles.
It is a principle of commercial law that a contract procured by fraud in the inducement can be rescinded.
Well, that may be where there's a good example of that. It's called an avoidance action. The Note case is a good example of that under Wisconsin law that's relied upon by Harley-Davidson, and that's a case where a party was sued for breach of contract and raised fraud as an affirmative defense to the contract claim, and the court said that's a contract type claim where you have an avoidance defense based on fraud and the inducement.
Maybe all this is just a question of pleading, but we're here in federal court. The pleading rules are federal. One doesn't plead tort or contract or anything else like that. One pleads claims. And it sounds like your answers are something that would occur in a code pleading state, but the federal courts aren't a code pleading jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, I'm looking at Home Value, which says that the there is no remedy for fraud in the inducement. No remedy. Those are the words of this court. And it doesn't say there are some remedies and maybe not others. It says no remedy. The Badger case says no remedy. And so I have to take those decisions for what they say. Rescission is a remedy. Harley-Davidson had a rescission remedy available to it. It filed a breach of contract claim, anticipatory repudiation, and discovery revealed that that claim just had no merit. And so Harley abandoned it. And now it's trying to recover through tort law what it couldn't get through contract law, because there are certain protections designed to prevent a he said, she said in a commercial negotiation where parties are represented by counsel. This would leave open the door in every single commercial case for a party to come in if they were unsatisfied and say, I was lied to. Second, and most importantly, this is no fraud case. The facts are undisputed on these fundamental points. I want to talk about the disclosure of the memo, because the facts are undisputed on that, and Harley just can't escape them. The undisputed facts are that clear back on December the 22nd of 1999, Power Sports sent a letter referring to the fact that it had some offering documents that were not yet finished. So Power Sports voluntarily discloses the existence of this document on December the 22nd. Some 2 weeks before the 60-day deadline. Then on New Year's Eve, December 31st, a Friday, Harley-Davidson sends a fax to Power Sports saying, please give us this private placement memo. Please send us the memo the Friday before New Year's holiday. The very next Monday, Power Sports faxes a letter to Power Sports saying that they will provide the draft memo to Harley-Davidson. What is significant about that? When Power Sports made that commitment to provide this memo, it had no idea whether or not Harley-Davidson was going to approve this deal. That is not a party trying to hide the ball. They made that commitment. The very next day, Power Sports FedEx, by priority overnight delivery, not just one copy of the memo, but two, one to Harley-Davidson and one to Harley-Davidson's counsel to facilitate Harley-Davidson's review.
Why isn't this a dispute for the trier of fact to determine once we get past the question of whether or not the court ought to be entertaining this rescission action or not? Seems to me now you're arguing the merits, and it seems to me the significance of these events, the transfer of memoranda and what have you, and the timing of them, it is really fairly basic fodder for a trier of fact.
Your Honor, it's because these facts are plainly undisputed. They were proposed facts that Harley-Davidson simply did not contest.
But the facts, but aren't there inferences to be drawn from these facts?
No.
With respect to the issue of fraud.
I don't think there's any inference. I don't think somebody can come in and say Power Sports concealed something and defrauded us when the undisputed facts show just the opposite, that Power Sports disclosed it and gave it to them. And now their excuse seems to be that it just sat in the mailroom and nobody bothered to go look at it. And the fact of the matter is, it is undisputed when Power Sports sent that memo on January the 4th, no decision about approval had been communicated. So Power Sports, again, they let the horse out of the barn without knowing whether or not they were going to be approved. That is not a party who's intending to deceive anybody or defraud anybody. And again, it's undisputed that the memo was actually delivered to Harley-Davidson in the morning of January the 5th before any decision was communicated by Harley-Davidson. Now, in Harley-Davidson's shoes, you've been told this memo's coming, you're about ready to approve. Wouldn't you pick up the phone and say, where is this memo that you promised? We're about ready to make a decision here, and where is the memo? This isn't a question of weighing
the
facts.
Isn't that a,
no,
isn't
it's
that
not, because it shows that this court doesn't have to accept absurd interpretations of the facts. These are undisputed facts. And I'm just dealing with the explanation that Harley has to try and deal with it. But it's absurd, and the court need not accept speculation.
Is it your argument that Power Sport never represented that it intended, that it did not intend, rather, to go public or transform itself into an internet concern?
It's our statement that Power Sports said at all times that it would comply with the dealer contract, and that for purposes of summary judgment, we don't need to get into what was said or wasn't said at the December 16th meeting, because Power Sports sent a letter on December 22nd that said to Harley loud and clear, we have a group of people out there who have warrants to buy stock. Those warrants become exercisable if and when Power Sports goes public, and we will agree to give you 60 days notice ahead of time before we attempt to go public.
So we don't have to consider whether or not Power Sports gave Harley-Davidson information that was inconsistent with the draft business plan.
Well, it's
business
our
plan, regardless of the fact that it waited until near the end of the time for Harley to make a decision regarding the transfer to disclose the fact.
Well,
what you're saying.
Well, yes, in part. The December 22nd letter, though, was quite a bit before the deadline, and that's the letter where Power Sports says we have these warrants out there, refers to plans to go public, and says we're not going to do it without your consent. We'll give you 60 days notice. And Harley-Davidson has admitted that simply testing your rights under Florida law, whether or not it's legal or illegal for Harley-Davidson to prevent public ownership, that's not a breach of the dealer contract. And these battles have been fought in this business with AutoNation and Sonic and some of the publicly owned dealerships. Those are the legal issues involved. And so, and it was perceived by Harley-Davidson as being inconsistent with what was said at the meeting. And that's another reason there was no fraud here. There's no reliance because Mr. Flickinger, the man from Harley-Davidson, said that this language about giving 60 days notice says that's starting to sound like they're going to give us legal notice, and despite the fact that they may have made oral promises on December 16th, it sounds now like they're going to rely on Florida law to protect them. And so that fact is undisputed, that was Harley-Davidson's reaction to this letter. So Based on that undisputed fact, that's yet another basis for no fraud in this case. We had written documents that spelled out what the situation was. Now, at the end of the day, this memo is not, simply not incompatible with complying with the dealer agreement. Harley's case fundamentally relies on this memo as revealing a fraud, but if we look at the whole memo and interpret it as this court can do, it says very clearly that Powersports, regardless of what's said, must operate in compliance with its franchise agreement. That is the number one risk factor disclosed in the document. That's what they intended to do. And so this memorandum is in no way incompatible with complying with the dealer agreement. And I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Raver. Thank you also, Mr. Stone. The case is taken under advisement.